Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
And welcome to From the Rooker End, a podcast about Watford FC brought to you by The Athletic. It's the international break, but we're still here with a very special podcast that really, it will get you thinking, I think, about your heroes, but not just your general heroes, your cult heroes. I'm joined by Mike.
Hello, John.
And Adam Leventhal.
Hello.
And we are going to talk about an article you've written about a certain player. Now, I'm going to try and be mysterious at this point, but of course, the title and the person of we're going to talk about will be in the title of this podcast. Whoever knows who we're going to be talking about. But you know, it's...
Why are you bothering, John?
Exactly. Why am I here? But it's about him being a cult hero. And you've written an article about Marco Cassetti. But how did this sort of come about? What is a cult hero for you, Adam?
It came about by just basically tracking him down for about a year and pestering him to try and do an interview. And over the last, 2 weeks, we managed to nail down a time. So it was really, really pleasing to finally sort of speak to him, because I've always sort of had a soft spot for Marco Cassetti. And then it coincided with a series that we're doing for The Athletic, which has the prefix of What Is It Like To Be? I thought that it fitted perfectly with What Is It Like To Be A Watford Cult Hero. In answer to your second part of your question, what is a cult hero? It's quite difficult to define, but I think that Marco Cassetti ticks so many of the boxes because, I suppose, his distinguished playing style, his distinguished facial furniture, his temperament, the moments of great and not so great that he had, and I think the fact that he also made such a strong connection with the football club, which comes across in the piece. So I hope I've sort of answered your question there, John.
Mike, you know, he we'll talk about him, you know, later on. We're also going to hear from him because Adam recorded the interview. And I've heard that interview, Adam, and I can hear the smile on your face throughout it. the fact that you got to speak to Marco the Beard Cassetti. But generally, Mike, for you, a cult hero, that, you know, Adam sort of said his stuff, and we chat about this with the WhatsApp group. It's really hard to find a definition. But what is it for you that makes a cult hero?
It is really, really difficult, and I think that's the answer to the question, isn't it? There is no set of baskets or boxes that have to be ticked, because the Venn diagram is quite big, isn't it? It could be a hero, and I'm waffling. This is how complicated it is, but I think it's someone with that little je ne sais quoi, just something different about them, something you can't quite put your finger on, but something just slightly offbeat, but in a good way, if that makes sense. Someone just sort of a little bit, hipster's not the right word because that goes too far the other way, but someone who just makes you smile, someone who sort of reminds you why you enjoy football and everything to do with it, really. It's just, it's an indefinable quality in lots of ways. And they're all so different. Cult heroes can be different. There can be some who had really distinguished careers. There's others that didn't. And yeah, it's a fascinating one to think about. But I think the best way of summing us is someone who makes you smile. Perhaps someone that other supporters wouldn't quite understand why you love them so much. I wonder if that makes sense.
It does. I mean, I think the longevity is an interesting thing. And we'll talk about a couple of possibilities soon. But I always think they have to burn brightly but briefly. you know, they're not around forever. And you almost have that element of, I saw him play. Yeah. Oh, did you see him play? Yeah. I saw those games. I saw that season. The problem with modern world is that you can look back at games and find the DVDs and you can watch them on YouTube. And it's almost like there's a certain mystery that still is around many players, I think, from the past. I know, I was talking about the hierarchy of players. You know, there's a legend. You know, and I think it's a phrase that gets overused so much. You know, a good player doesn't make you a legend. You know, there's something about, you know, adding significant amount to the club. And that's exactly what Colt Hill doesn't do. They add something, but not a lot.
Yeah, well, this is it. See, this is the problem you see, John, because while you're talking there, and I've talked about this Venn diagram, I've got a player in mind who I think is a legend and a cult hero.
You can't be both. You cannot be both.
Well, here you go. Here's a stress test, then. I think Tony Cotton is a club legend and a cult hero because he's a club legend for what he achieved with Watford. He was absolutely brilliant for a long period of time. But also he had that sort of mischievous air about him. We know now that he's got that incredible sense of humour. We know that he was fearsome on the pitch and he's a larger than life character off it. He's not your standard 9-to-5 footballer. He was loads going on, basically. So brilliant footballer, brilliant servant for Watford. Of course, hanging on for that extra year when they got relegated is a good example of that. But he had that edge to him, didn't he? Sort of, I think he was a couple of brushes with not necessarily obeying laws the whole time when he was younger. I don't know if Tony's lawyers are listening. Let's hope not. But do you know what I mean? So I think he could be a hero and a legend and a cult hero. And there's another one, Hyder, who I think probably just about could tick over into club legend, but he had that sort of slightly balmy sense about him, the way he played football, the way he charged around. He wasn't your standard striker, and then he bustled around. He never looked massive, but then of course it transpired that he had a better hang time than Michael Jordan. So he was almost ticking over into club legend, but also a cult hero as well. You know, he was called the Puffin Eater and all that sort of stuff. And he just he was slightly off beam.
A nickname is very important, I think. But for me, the bit that those players both had, and this is where Colt Hero also needs, I think Watford needs to be the top of their career. They can't go off to bigger heights. We can be theirs on the way down. They might have had highs before us, but after us, I don't think they can have heights. And both those players went on to much bigger football clubs and much more sort of success after Watford. It's one of those football cliches, and it's very important that we get the proper definition, or at least his proper definition, of what a cult hero is. We got in touch with Adam Hurry, who is known as @footballclichés on Twitter, and he hosts the Football Clichés podcast as part of The Athletic, and we found out what he thought was the definition of a cult hero.
Cult heroism in football is kind of a deliberately and conveniently slippery concept. You have to think of it in terms of like a Venn diagram, and you need to fit it into at least one of these following circles. None of them actually involve being consistently good at football, though. The first one is kind of like a superhuman work ethic, kind of this innocent application to your trade that the average punter kind of will really appreciate. That's pretty basic. The second one is kind of a mid-range violent tendencies. It's not enough to make you a complete scumbag. It's just enough to make you look like you're really fighting for the cause. So just general low-level dark arts. Third one is maverick flashes of exotic talent, a typical kind of foreign import who plays well for a bit, gets cold and then leaves. That's enough for cult heroism these days. Fourth, it's got an innocently playful social media presence. It's quite a modern thing, but kind of just sort of really innocently engaging with the average punters on Twitter is always quite a nice thing, showing that you're humble and don't take yourself too seriously. Finally, if you simply score precisely once against your club's most bitter rivals, that's usually enough. But if you do go on to score 200 more, then your cult heroism gets taken away because you're just too good. So I hope that solves the equation for you.
So Mike, you've done the classic. You've taken definitions. You've started to put players in, but you're not quite sure. Adam, you've spoken to many ex-footballers, ex-Watford players. How many of them don't tick the box of either legend, fan favourite, or even the lowest one? What's below fans' favourite, Adam?
Former Watford player. I mean, that's not to demean them. You know, you can still be a really good former player, but you just don't have anything necessarily snazzy about you. I wouldn't want to name names, but I think there's probably a fair few from the sort of the 90s that could have been sort of former players, just standard former players without any sort of cultishness about them or any legend status. I wanted to go back actually, John, because Mike, when you were talking about Tony Cotton, I wonder whether you can be a cult hero and be decorated by the club. Can you be a player of the year on not once, not twice, but three occasions,
no,
and also be a cult hero? And I get what you're saying about Tony Coton, because, yes, he has got a character that is larger than life and has all the sort of characteristics of a cult hero. But it's almost as if, yes, people would have been aware of it at the time, that he was an interesting character outside of the game as well. But we've almost learned more about that, and we've absorbed more of who he was, probably since, and doing, you know, doing the Tales from the Vicarage events and things like that. So I wonder whether we're sort of we're retrospectively giving him cult hero status. I don't know.
Here's one, let's go to the other end of the spectrum then. And this is one that's been sort of percolating in my mind for a couple of days. Xavier Gravelin.
Oh, all over.
Yeah?
Yeah, definitely.
Is that a bit more like it, do you think?
Pale skin, so he's got a standout character. He played for a very short amount of time, and Jason has a Christmas snowman named after him. I mean, that's got to be a cult hero. Maybe at least a cult player. But Adam, you spoke in another article we did for The Athletic about a certain cult. Is he a cult hero, or was it just a cult moment?
I think you're talking about a certain Albert McLenahan, who had a moment of infamy, didn't he, that we've talked about previously on the podcast. And I think that, yes, he would be a cult hero, yet would it be a cult moment? Would it just be a moment of unfortunate infamy? I mean, I suppose that the interesting thing is that sometimes when you go back and you speak to someone that you are sort of branding as a cult hero, it's always interesting to find out if there are some telltale signs of whether they are actually a cult hero. And I think what defines a cult hero, or helps to define a cult hero, is whether they have been emotionally invested in the football club themselves. Certainly felt that with Albert McLenahan, you know, even down to sort of having the pictures up on the wall and, you know, a Watford cap and wanting to go back to the football club and being a little bit unsure about how he was going to be treated when he went back. You know, do they really like me? Will they make fun of me? And that also came across with Marco Cassetti as well in the interview, that, you know, he wasn't sure after the penalty incident, more against Crystal Palace rather than Leicester, but whether they will ever forgive me for that, because, you know, we had Championship football rather than Premier League football. And I think that shows within the cult hero status that, yeah, they are as invested in that period of time that they were at the football club as the fans are, that have that sort of glow about them when they think about that player. So I think the emotional connection is just an extra little bit of magic stardust that you need to have had to be a cult hero.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So, Adam, it's been a while since I've seen Marco. I miss him. You got to meet him. How is he doing? How is he?
First things first, it was a joy to sort of sit on Zoom. Obviously, I wasn't there with him, but just to see his face smiling, for him to be sort of engaged in the process, that's always rewarding. I mean, you know, we've sat in front of so many Zoom press conferences over the last few months where managers have sat down sort of sullen-faced and going, answering questions about, you know, this and that and whatever. It's always quite fun to be speaking to someone who you're really excited to see and to speak to and relive their memories. Not being disrespectful to Nigel Pearson or Vladimir Ivic or anything like that, but, you know, you get what I mean. He is back in Brescia, which is his homeland. That's where he was born. He's moved back from Rome. He found the sort of the city culture a little bit too chaotic. And he's moved back there, you know, with his wife and his two children, who are a lot older now. And it's worth remembering that when he actually moved over to Watford, he didn't come with his family. And I suppose that reflects the fact that it was a sort of a suck it and see sort of move. You know, he came over via being on loan at Udinese, and he wasn't quite sure whether it was going to be a long-term relationship or not. Obviously, it lasted two seasons, as we know. But now he's, you know, back with his family, and he seems to be enjoying life. And it was quite interesting, you know, during the interview, almost sort of stereotypically, there was this Italian soundtrack, soundscape in the background of, you know, a little rattle of a Lambretta just sort of fizzing off into the background, and occasionally he would sort of have a little puff on his e-cigarette and there'd be sort of a plume of smoke like the exhaust that was coming out of the Lambretta outside. It was all very sort of evocative, just watching him and hearing him and speaking to him. So that sort of, you know, helped to set the scene of speaking to him. And I started off by asking him about, you know, how it actually came about that Marco Cassetti ended up playing at Vicarage Road.
After Rome, I was at home still training alone. My agent picked with some teams, but they don't want me too much because I was 35 years old. The last season with Luis Enrique in Roma, I didn't play too much because we have some little problem between us. And the other team in Italy, they said, oh, maybe it's finished, he can't play anymore. So my agent talked with Udinese. He called me, he said, there is this possibility if you want. I come in England for 10 days. I did a prove to test my condition, my fitness, my injury, everything. I was okay, and everything started from there. At the beginning, it was an experience for me. It's a new experience for my life, for improving my English. At the moment, I didn't know too much about Championship, just the Premier League, because I was looking the game in TV, but the Championship in Italy, never seen before, no? I like it from the beginning. It's a type of football we try to do with Gianfranco. We did a little bit different at that time. Gianfranco, he preferred to play this type of football. We did very well in the first season, a little bit less in the second, but, you know, the football is dead. The atmosphere, every game was fantastic, away and at the home. At the end, when they finished in England, they said, wow, why I don't come early? But it's always like this. For me, at the moment, maybe Premier League, the best league in the world. The Championship is not too far. Second, third place, you know, in Italy is so and so. Spain, just two teams, Real Madrid and Barcelona, sometimes Atletico Madrid, but Championship is always a surprise. For that, I love to watch the game. In Italy now, you can watch Friday games, sometimes Saturday, 12:30, one, two games a week, you can see.
You always worry, though, Adam, when a player comes in, you love them as much as you love them, but actually they didn't enjoy themselves as much as you hope they did.
Yeah, and that was definitely something that came through in the piece, that, you know, he was very open and, you know, his heart was very much open. And as you would expect, you know, his sort of Italian mannerisms were always there, and he was using his hands to describe the connection and the love that he had for not only the football club, but just the whole environment. I think that that really is very sort of vivid in his mind, that he was able to come to England and enjoy the sort of the freedom of playing football in England, because he'd been in the pressure cooker atmosphere of playing for Roma numerous times, competing right at the top of Serie A, almost won the title, was playing in the Champions League as well. And, you know, the scrutiny that he had in Italy was contrasted to, you know, arriving in leafy Hertfordshire, not really being known, playing the level down as well. And, yeah, it was a release for him. He could just enjoy football again.
Rome is fantastic. If you win, the top. If you lose, the bottom. In England, it was different. They love what you do on the pitch without the result. Just the performance, just the way you can try your best, when you can try to help the team, just this. That, I think, I have a lot of love from the Watford fan. If in Italy I did the penalty in the playoff championship, I don't know, maybe I must change city. In England, when I come back last year from the Watford Fulham at home, I receive a lot of love from the fans with no problem for that foul, for the penalty. I assume a responsibility for the penalty in the final, but for me, still now, it's no penalty against Leinster. Eh? Without that penalty, that game maybe finished like a normal game. A lot of people, they can see that video, they remember me that, oh, wow. Tell me why, what happened. It's difficult to say. You must live that moment.
So obviously he enjoyed the majority of the time playing in England, but obviously I had to talk to him about two particular penalty incidents. You know, we talked about the penalty against Crystal Palace, which he, you know, really took to his heart, and he was very worried about, you know, whether the Watford fans were going to remember that when he returned. But I suppose that the more famous one, and the one that has a happy ending, was that penalty against Leicester. And this is what he said.
I can't believe it. Because, you know, I played that year. It was the semi-final playoff. We already played more than 40 games in the league. I understood what the referee, like the referee, tried to ref the game in the league all the year. The contact never whistled before. So I said to myself, no, I can't believe it. He whistled a penalty with just to touch in the shoulder a little bit, to use my body to cover the ball. I can't believe it. You know, Almunia did his job very well. After the first save from Almunia, and I saw Knockert to put the ball on the net. Almunia said he put the arm and they stopped the ball. I was alive, me and Joel Ekstrand was together, like a central back. Never think now we can score. Was amazing, fantastic. I saw the people from the stand coming to the pitch. I remember when the police tried to clear the pitch because the referee said there are 40 seconds to play again. They tried to put the ball in the box. Crazy.
Adam, you know, he only had two managers when he was at Watford, which is quite a unique thing. But for him, they were very special managers. He had Zola, of course, who, you know, his role really at Watford was to help, I think, define this new Watford with Zola. But then he also had Beppe Cennino.
He did. And watching him talk about that was very, very funny, because it's an interesting one, because you're never quite sure, especially when they're a fellow countryman, whether he saw something in Beppe Cennino that we completely missed, and that we had a complete misconception about Beppe Cennino simply being someone who was very, very shouty, very, very energetic, and a little bit crackers at times. But no, he pretty much agreed with that take on Beppe Cennino. And ultimately, he concedes in the piece that if Beppe Cennino hadn't have been around after that second season, he probably would have stayed longer.
Total different way to work on the pitch. When I come in England with Zola, he played a lot of year in England. He was an English, he's not an Italian. And with him, I understand what is the football in England. No? When I come, Cennino, I felt like in Italy 10 years before, a lot of tactical, 2 hours and a half in the pitch to do the movement like this. I try to speak with Pepe. When he come, he asked me, how do you feel? How is the football here? How is the team? You know, that type of question. I say to him, listen, here, for me, is the paradise. You can ask to the team everything you want. They do, without problem. But it's the type of method if you ask. It doesn't hurt me. And for that, I remember Gianluca Nani was the director. He asked me to stay for the third year. But you know, with Beppe, for that, I say no. Another year like this, no. If you come in England, in English, coach, I can do another year, 37. My family want me back because I was alone in England just one time a month. Come back at home for a couple of days. It was hard. And for that, I decided to come back in Italy.
You had to ask him about it, Adam, didn't you? You had to ask him about the bid.
Of course. That's, you know, it's the frame of Marco Cassetti. You know, it is the thing that people remember, that wonderful facial furniture. And, you know, I did actually ask him straight up, you know, did you almost feel that you were a style icon when you came? And what came across, and I wasn't sure if he was going to be sort of all full of bravado and all this sort of stuff. He's very humble. And, you know, this is how he responded by being compared to, you know, some sort of great style icons that we know in England.
I'm not like a Beckham. I'm not... Now I feel good with the bird. Sometimes a little bit longer, sometimes a little bit shorter, but I can see me in the mirror without. Maybe in the future, but I don't think so. Particular signal, no? The identity and the ID.
But do you feel he still has a connection with Watford, or has he sort of left us behind?
I think he does still have a very, very strong connection with the club. And you can hear that in his voice, can't you? You know, that the passion that he speaks with. You know, he loves watching the clips on social media when Deeney goal, the goal that he set up for Matej Vidra. Let's not forget that wonderful assist. He played a big part in that Huddersfield goal as well, which goes around on social media now and again. And he keeps in touch with some of the former players as well. Nathaniel Shalabar, you know, he was in touch with him when he came over for the Fulham game, because Shalabar had that link with Napoli and was learning Italian as well. So they've exchanged a few messages. Troy Deeney as well. Jonathan Hogg too. And also, you know, from his point of view, he's sort of trying to build his coaching career as well. He works alongside Christian Panucci. They were in charge of Albania for a period of time. He's got his UEFA Pro license. So he's sort of, you know, steadily working his way through and looking for, you know, the next opportunity. And I asked him about potentially, you heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen, the opportunity for Marco Cassetti to become the head coach of Watford. Imagine that.
It's my dream. In my dream, for sure, one day we will be. I don't know if in Watford or I hope in Watford, but for sure is one of my target to come in England to manage as a coach.
Mike, I'm not going to lie to you. I sort of don't want him to come back as coach. I think it will ruin it. I've never got back with an ex-girlfriend, but I worry that's what it would be like.
Do you know what? I'm the exact opposite. Just hearing Adam utter those words then, I was off my seat just thinking, oh, can you imagine? It'd be absolutely, no offence.
No, I have that feeling as well. I just don't want to ruin it.
I know what you mean. And listening back, and I think it is worth all the effort that Adam went to track Marco down and to nail him down to get that chat. Because what a magnificent, well, just lovely to hear from him, wasn't it? On a load of levels. What I loved about him was, to your earlier point, John, was that he obviously holds Watford in such high regard, and still does. And that's very rewarding to hear as a supporter who is sort of who loves him as well. But just the way he was sort of so honest about it, the sort of trajectory, his Watford career trajectory was really interesting. I love the fact that he said he was honest enough to say he'd never even seen the Championship before Watford became an option. And then how he described, you know, as Adam said, moving from Rome, where basically it's either you're a god or the devil, effectively, was what he said, wasn't it? You're either the top or the bottom. You're either brilliant or useless. To moving to Watford, where we love him, like we've been talking about in this podcast, we love him for what he did on the pitch and forgave him that the error against Crystal Palace to the extent really that most people probably don't even remember it. And he obviously appreciates that the English football supporters and Watford football supporters recognise your efforts and enjoy what you try and do for the team and the badge. And I love the way that came through. And in talking about Beppe, I love the fact that he was honest to say, I think the quote was, it felt like he was from a decade earlier.
Yeah.
Basically alluding to the fact that he was a bit outdated in his methods. And yeah, what might have been if Pepe hadn't been around, but also that Pepe used him as help and he was willing to help him. He described it as paradise. Just a thread of lovely, lovely stuff, and really nice to hear from him from that cult hero point of view. And I think that just cements it for me. As I was listening back to it, one of the things I was remembering was he did seem to have a smile on his face. He seemed content in this chat, and he seemed generally a happy footballer. And even when, I think, was it away against Peterborough, he got sent off. I think we were there, John and Jace was there. He got sent off quite early on, and he sort of throws his arm at the ref and just runs off laughing, basically. Just sort of saying, "Well, that's what a load of rubbish. I'll go and have my luxurious bath now in my Italian bath salts or whatever." But he just what a lovely sort of section of his career it was, and how lucky we were to have it. It was of course a pretty momentous, tumultuous, incident packed couple of years, wasn't it, that he was with Watford for. There was plenty going on, and that of course helps, but just what a top guy. But aside from all that, some real interesting nuggets, some real nice behind the scene detail of what it was like at that time. So on a number of levels, that was absolutely fantastic. Loved every minute of hearing from him direct, and every minute of reading the piece as well. Absolutely brilliant. Lovely to hear from him. And yes, bring him back. If you are going to get back with the next John, he's got to be the one, surely.
You know what? One thing that was funny when I was speaking to him, and it sort of fitted together as he was talking, and I was thinking, what? Hang on a minute. Hold on. Because he was describing why he and Christian Panucci, I think this is driven by Panucci more than him, but why they don't want to work in Italy is because, you know, and it harps back to the pressure that he felt at Roma, that, you know, that you only get a short period of time to prove yourself. The owners are very quick to act, and they, you know, they start to sort of, in you know, bring intense pressure on you if results aren't going your way. And, you know, you don't really get that when you're outside of Italy. And I did go, it is like that at Watford, though. You do realise. and he just sort of burst out laughing, and he went, because he's Italian. And it was like, you know, it was just a lovely moment that he, you know, whilst he got Watford at the time, and he was part of a wonderful sort of story of transition, he does also appreciate that, you know, things haven't really changed at Watford now. And yeah, it would be a very, very interesting combination. And I look, it's one for the sort of the dreamers to have Cassetti in charge of Watford. But just imagine the combination, and we can just dream, can't we? We can dream of having a cult hero back at the football club in some form. But whatever happens, and he learnt this coming back to watch the game against Fulham. He feared coming back a little bit because he didn't know what the reception was, but he knows full well that whenever he does come back to the club, people will go, that's Marco Cassetti. I love you. I love your beard. I love all these moments. And just, you know, it will always be a warm embrace when he comes back.
Absolutely. Hugs all round when Marco is around. Thank you very much for that, Adam. It's really fantastic. If you do want to read that article, it's live on The Athletic now, and you can get access to it by going to theathletic.com/rookeryend, and right there you can sign up for £1 a week as a subscription, which is well worth it.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
From the Rookery End, a podcast about life following Watford FC.
Another thing, Adam, The Athletic have done this week, and one of their many podcasts that they put out, which From the Rookery End is one, is the Ornstein and Chapman podcast, where normally they chat to you guys, the journalists, and try and pick apart some of the big stories from the week. But this week, Ornstein, David, had a chat to one Mr. Nigel Pearson. We got to listen to that. You can listen to the whole interview with Nigel on the Ornstein and Chapman feed, wherever you get your podcast. But we got it, and we cut out the bits, apart from the bits where he talked about Watford. And this is what Nigel had to say to David about his time at Vicarage Road.
What was it like working inside that Watford regime? Is that bad for your health? Because from the outside, it looks fairly chaotic, this hiring and firing of managers.
I, for the most part, really enjoy it. I didn't have a lot of, you know, since I've left, people expect there to be, they make the presumptions that there's conflicts and there's argument. You know, there was nothing. I can't give you any answers because I've got no idea apart from anecdotal stories that I've heard that, you know, he just wanted his change and see whether the players would react. Well, if that's what it is, that's what it is. I can't do anything about it. So I'm not going to lose any sleep over it now. But, you know, I'm talking about at the time, yeah, I was furious and I was annoyed, of course. But because it was an opportunity for me to get back into the Premier League that I didn't think would be available to me again. So yeah. I was very grateful for the opportunity. Hey, it's what it is.
I guess in fairness to the media, those sort of questions and that curiosity is fueled by incidents like which happened at the end for you, which seemed quite extraordinary that you were denied entry to the training ground and players and staff found out about... supposed deep clean.
Yeah, possibly. I'm a bit of a wily old dog as well in the fact that I made sure I rang the doctor to make sure, you know, is there a deep clean? No, there isn't. Craig and I tried to arrange our practice match then. I said, okay, then we'll go down to the stadium to train. We couldn't train there because there was work being done to the pitch, which, so I just got in contact with the ground staff and no, there wasn't any work being done. But they were told that if I got in contact to tell them that I could, you know, I couldn't use it. You don't have to be an absolute genius to work out that there's something possibly going on. Me being probably seeking a little bit of confrontation made sure I got to the training ground early so that they had to turn me away. You use your sort of, I don't know, your nous to try and work things out. So it wasn't a shock when it happened in the end. Yeah. Although, you know, the timing of it wasn't probably what I expected. But, you know, the stories that came about, the halftime at West Ham, yeah, I wasn't at all happy.
A post-match row with Gino Pozzo?
I didn't see him. He was at the training ground watching it. He was at the training ground with the sporting director. There was no argument to have. You know, the last time I saw the owner and Scott Duxbury was in the car park the next day. So there was nothing said then either.
And it was especially surprising from the outside because you had posted a couple of wins and got the team into good contention to survive before the sort of rug was pulled from beneath your feet. One interesting part was when you came back, and we now know for Project Restart, there was a lot of politics. There was also your ill health. There were positive tests at Watford. Troy Deeney, obviously a talismanic figure, wasn't coming back to training for his own concerns. There was a lockdown breach with players attending a party. Was that chaotic, that period? Because then what followed was a run of defeats. Was that particular time before you picked up with a couple of victories a bit of a mess? There were so many different issues.
It's not about excuses. It's about this. These were the circumstances that we worked in. And however other clubs worked, and it doesn't matter how they worked, because we worked with the scenario that we had, and a number of our players have got big concerns, and I don't blame them. And I don't blame them. Yeah. You know, but did it have an effect? Well, I think, you know, if you look at all the, and it continues now, actually, the number of strange results that, you know, since restart, even through the start of this, that there have been results that you wouldn't predict necessarily. So who knows how the changing climate with, you know, the fans not being there. I mean, I think that was difficult for us because playing at home for us was a massive dimension to us. And I think there's a lot of football clubs would feel the same. It's very difficult to predict how the circumstances affected everybody. But look, we all had to deal with it. And I would still say that, okay, so the seven games after restart, we got 7 points. So it's a point per game. And over the course of a season, you know, that was only marginally below what we'd been averaging before. It wasn't what we wanted, don't get me wrong. You know, we expected to do better than that. It was just a situation which it felt different. People talk about momentum. You had to deal with a situation that was not necessarily what we expected it to be.
One specific player I wanted to ask you about, Ismail Assar. He's had a lot of interest in him in the transfer window that's just gone, specifically from Liverpool. How special is he? And also, would clubs come to you and ask for your advice on him? Have they? And what would you say?
Firstly, no, I've not been asked about him specifically in terms of clubs wanting my opinion on him as a player. My own opinion is, you know, a young man who's very, very talented. There was a part of me that was surprised that he didn't go in the window, but I think if Watford can, and they've also been quite canny with Jerry De La Feuz and Maxi Pereira, both at Udinese. So, you know, so that there's an opportunity, I think, that if they get promoted this year, that they'll still have retain the services of their best players. And I think, you know, you would look at that as say, well, that's good business, really, if that can be the case. And I think for Sarr, for instance, it would be the Championship might be a really good experience for him, you know, because I think at times there was an awful lot of expectation on the lad's shoulders. I think if they're still doing really well by the January window, you know, they'll probably keep him again. And he's a very talented boy, but I think it's very, I'm always loath to build the expectation too much on players like that, because they're going to have moments. And he's had some injury issues as well. So I think he's another year acclimatizing in the English game, maybe with not the level of pressure on him, might be very, very beneficial for him. But he's certainly a very talented boy.
Adam, you were there. You covered every game, every incident, every moment of Nigel's time at Watford. You always wonder about when someone will talk, not the truth, the full truth. And it seems to me a little bit that Nigel is talking to lots of people for a very specific reason.
It's a very interesting one. And I'm not sure whether I would have done quite as many interviews all in one go, when you could have probably just sort of chosen one journalist to speak to, or one publication. But he did do a, you know, a whole sort of junket's worth of interviews.
Nigel Pearson, the movie's not coming out, is it?
Well, I don't know. You know, Nigel Pearson and the Wild Dogs, or whatever it would be called, or whatever. Yeah. But there was just a lot of interviews, and it was sort of quite pronounced how much Pearson content there was out initially when he did the interviews. And you know, I thought it was great listening to Stu James, who was one of the carefully selected journalists to go and speak to Nigel Pearson, and he was representing The Athletic. And I really enjoyed his piece, because it was sort of going at Nigel Pearson's time, but also his life and the challenges that he's had, in particular, you know, losing his mother, but also having COVID recently and seemingly still struggling with it a little bit, from sort of outside the Watford bubble. And then the interview, as we've heard, with Nigel Pearson, with Ornstein and Chapman, was able to just dig in a little bit more on the precise details of what happened. And I thought there was some good sort of little behind the scenes bits that were sort of conceded, which hadn't appeared in the various publications interviews that we'd heard before. And I think in general, it is, let's remember, his take on things, just from his perspective. But there is no reason to think that he is saying anything happened that didn't happen, or it didn't happen the way that he's saying it. And, you know, he's always been pretty straight when he's been speaking about things. But I think we learnt a few things in terms of his emotions at the time, that it was very, very, I almost sort of picture him the day after the West Ham game, with his blood just boiling, gradually just turning his face redder and redder and redder as the day was unfolding, and he realised that he was going to be sacked, and the sort of the injustice of the whole thing in his eyes. But you then have to contrast that with what many, many Watford fans, you know, however you think that it was dealt with, and whether he, you know, it wasn't classy in the way that the club did it, and this and that and whatever. The narrative was there. Watford were going down, and they were going down with a whimper. the starts that they were churning out in many of the games. Yes, they beat Norwich. Yes, they beat Newcastle. But they were pitching up and they looked as if they were sort of turning up for a kickabout on the park, especially. And this is the one that really, really got to me. And it really sort of set the tone for the whole of that period of time after lockdown when they came out like a rabble against Leicester.
Oh, don't start. Don't.
And I just thought...
I hated it.
It really... Look, okay, fair enough. People were walking into something that they'd never experienced before. But the bare minimum is to walk out in line and look as if you're up for the fight. They did all right against Leicester. And that was probably one of the better performances post-lockdown, let's be honest. But I just thought, come on, what is going on here? Something's missing. And I think from what Nigel was saying in a lot of his interviews, yes, there were a lot of contributory factors. I think personally, it would have helped him if he'd been a little bit more honest about what was going on for him personally in terms of his illness. I think the club as a whole could have, you know, been even more transparent. And I think it would have helped personally. I think that would have, you know, been better. But then I can also understand from the point of view of someone that's, you know, he's quite stubborn and he's quite sort of stoic. He didn't want to sort of be seen as someone that was, you know, in inverted commas, weak and, you know, suffering. And he wanted to sort of set an example. So I can see both sides of the argument. But what interested me from when he was speaking in that interview to sort of contrast the two things. At the time, he was upset with how it was playing out with the Premier League and sitting in a lot of meetings and feeling that things were a little bit, that they weren't transparent enough and people weren't being upfront about the fact that, come on, look, we're just getting on with this because we have to save football almost, even if it's not necessarily the safest thing to be doing. So he wanted more honesty on that side of things. And now I sort of have learnt more about what was going on with him. You know, he missed the Brentford game. We were told, no, it's nothing. Speaking to Craig Shakespeare in a press conference, everything okay with Nigel? Yeah, he's fine. Come on. You know, you have to have it both ways. If you're asking for honesty on one side, you also have to be honest on the other side as well. And I think that that's what sort of came through with that, you know, interview with Ornstein and Chapman. And it's really worth having a listen. And then, you know, rereading the Stu James piece as well. And then also rereading the piece that I did back when he was sacked, which also fills in some of the other details. And you can almost sort of pin it up like Carrie Matheson in Homeland and sort of have all the bits up on the wall. And then we can work out in a year's time when we try and find out definitively exactly what happened and piece it all together, the bits that are missing. But all in all, it was really interesting hearing from him. It was his perspective, and I don't necessarily think that it will have changed the minds of Watford fans in terms of whether he would have been able to do anything differently in those final two games. I think people will think if he had been in charge for the Man City game and for the Arsenal game, Watford wouldn't have come any closer to staying up. And that was the perception outside of the club. How can you sack someone with two games to go? You know, this is Nigel Pearson. He's had a great record, blah, 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 blah. Well, that wasn't the reality. And I think we all know that. So I genuinely wish him all the best. And I contacted him outside of the interviews and all this sort of stuff to wish him well on a human level. I hope you're well and, you know, in your recovery and all that sort of stuff. And that was done. But on a football side of things, you know, he's put things out there. People can respond. And I think it's all part of the, as he used the phrase as well in the interview and sort of, you know, he says he doesn't really like it. But, you know, we've had Nigel Pearson in the rich tapestry of Watford Football Club. And it was a fascinating episode. Didn't end well. And there was a lot of serious things going on. But, you know, it was an interesting tale at the end of the day.
Mike, is Nigel Pearson or Beppe Cennino a cult manager?
Gosh, what a good question. I reckon Beppe definitely is.
Definitely. Just for the lining on his suits.
Yeah, he had his initial sort of etched into his cuffs. So he had plenty of going on, didn't he? He had, so he's a cult manager. And the sort of curious case of Nigel Pearson, I think had he kept us up and then rode off into the sunset, then he probably would have been a cult figure, a cult head coach. Doesn't quite have the same ring to it, does it? but just to finish off on that, it was fascinating to hear from him because as Adam alluded to, he has done a lot of interviews and we've read the piece that Stu did with him, which was of The Athletic, which was obviously great. And there's been quotes all over the place. But interesting to physically be able to hear hear him, and it does remind you that he does come across as very articulate and calm and considered. And over the most part of the piece, it didn't sound like he harboured any ill will towards Watford, despite, as Adam's saying, he sort of mapped out that day where he tried to get to the training ground, then tried to get to Vicarage Road, and was sort of foiled at every turn. It was sort of quite a sort of vaguely amusing for us, I suppose, to imagine Gino Pozzo and Scott Duxbury behind a tree at his next destination, stopping him from doing what he wanted to do.
Is he coming around the corner? Yes, yeah. duck!
Barrier down. Now! So, but just getting that sort of detail, you know, all joking aside, was interesting. But I did, he is softly spoken, and like I say, he didn't seem to harbour any overt ill will towards Watford. But I did think his tone did harden slightly when he talked about the West Ham game, and I think he mentioned that Gino was watching the game from the training ground. He wasn't at the London Stadium, so dispelling any rumours of a bust-up with the owner either during or after the game there. You know, he was at pains to point out that Gino was watching the game with the technical director, I think, is it, which I take to mean Filippo Giraldi. So there was suggestions that there was a bust-up there. So I thought his tone hardened a little bit when talking about that particular incident, but then he went on to say that he was cross, like the rest of us were. Fascinating to hear from him. As Adam said, and as we said when we spoke to Stu in the last podcast, we wish, on a personal level, wish him nothing but well. He's obviously been through a tough time. It's been a tough time for everyone, and none more so than him. So on a human level, all the very best to him. But I think we're ready as Watford supporters now. It's been a fascinating sort of period, you know, to hear from him again and to try and piece some of it together. But they are sort of, it's still quite open wounds, aren't they? You know, we're still sort of dealing with the fallout of relegation, and so it is quite a difficult listen, but well worth it. It's a great written piece and well worth tuning into Ornstein and Chapman to listen to as well. Fascinating as always.
The podcast, of course, free wherever you get your podcast from, as this podcast is, but you can get them ad-free by going to theathletic.com/rookeryend. And the three podcasts we mentioned, not only ourselves, but also the Ornstein and Chapman podcast and Football Clichés, you can get ad-free on the Athletic website and app. Thank you very much for your time, Adam, and thank you so much for sharing that interview with Marco Cassetti.
No problem. And just if anyone wants to drop a comment in the podcast on The Athletic with someone that they would like to be interviewed in the future, let's get that conversation going. Some other sort of cult heroes or some former players. whoever. It's always good to know who people would love to hear from. So, yeah, nice one.
Who's top of your list, Michael, for that one?
What, for cult players?
Yeah, to speak to, yeah.
Oh, that's a really good question.
Mine's still Glenn Hodges, by the way.
Glenn Hodges. So, Glenn, if you're listening, what about
Dave Bamber?
Yes! That's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, similar era. It's not too much of a jump from Glenn Hodges. Maybe no. we could do a double date, John. Me and you take Glenn Hodges and Dave Bamber out for a delicious meal.
You're paying. We'll be back with other podcasts about life following Watford FC. But please make sure you follow us on social media and do tell your friends to subscribe wherever they get their podcasts from. Come on, you all!